Knobs is brought to you by Atomic Film and Design. Atomic Film and Design has helped dozens of corporate and creative clients strengthen their brand with graphic web and film design from historic concert venues, local businesses, and record labels. Atomic Film and Design works with a network of creative professionals like me to uncover what makes your business or band truly unique. Show the world what you can do. With a little help from Atomic Film and Design, start your new project now at atomicfilmshop.com. I am very excited to also announce that we have a brand new sponsor for the show, and I have to say, it is an absolute perfect fit. This episode of Knobs is also brought to you by Pedal Genie. Every day you wait before joining Pedal Genie is another day you could have spent sampling over 1,800 different pedals from classic effects makers and boutique companies alike. It's Pedal Genie's mission to connect musicians with the right effects, not just the ones you think you want, but the ones you never knew you needed because you didn't have the opportunity to find out. If you live in the U.S., for one low monthly fee, Pedal Genie offers musicians endless opportunities to evolve their sound. Create your pedal wish list from their extensive selection, and they'll ship one to your door. Whenever you're done, you send it back to exchange for another. It's that easy. Join now at pedalgenie.com. Right? Come on, Pedal Genie? Doesn't get much better than that for a show like this.
You're listening to Knobs, a podcast created by music geeks for music geeks. Now, here's your hosts, Matt Diamond and Chris Nickel.
Come on in. Welcome back to another episode of Knobs Podcast. I am Matt Diamond.
And I am Christopher Nickel.
Welcome back. You landed safely. When did you get back to our fine country? Like yesterday?
Yeah, yesterday. We got back to Toronto around 8:30 in the evening, I believe, and then back to our humble abode here in the country around midnight. So yeah, by no efforts of Houston airport, we made it back safely. So, but what an absolute shit show in Houston, man. I've never seen an airport like I saw yesterday. That was a mess.
Really?
An absolute. Oh, it was disgusting. We were like 3 hours through a security check and then through another security check and then go through the mandatory new Donald Trump security check. And like,
oh,
it's like,
God.
Oh, dude, my wife and I were just sitting there, and you got two kids who are kind of like hungry and were just losing it in this lineup, man. It was mad.
The airport is not stressful enough, but I will say this, that there are certain airports in North America that make your life really, really easy and that are friendly and have a smile, and others that they make me never want to travel or fly.
Yeah.
And I'm not going to name anybody. I don't want to offend anyone anyway, but I don't like to fly anymore, man. Like the airport experience for me is enough to make me not want to do it ever again.
We should have known. We're like, you know, not to get political on this podcast, but we're flying into Texas 2 days before Donald Trump's inauguration of the 45th president of the United States. So we landed at the same time again, not to get too political, but we landed at the exact same time as like three or four other flights from countries on the new no-no list. We were going through the same rigmarole that all of the other people were going through, and it was not only was it disheartening to see how people were being treated, but it was also really kind of frustrating. So
we'll bookend that portion of this conversation by saying by saying we love everyone.
And we do, yes.
No matter where you are listening from. In fact, we discussed Texas in this interview with the lovely Sarah Lipstate and Noveller, because she was once a resident of there as well. Yeah. We just don't want to spread any hate. And regardless of what side of the fence you're on when it comes to our soon-to-be president-elect Donald Trump, I just don't give a shit about being political. And we spread love to to everybody. And I don't know enough about it anyhow. But I will say this, that we want everybody to feel welcome here and to spread the love of the show, whether you're listening from another planet or you are in Canada or the U.S. or anywhere else. So
no, just the Houston airport. You suck. Houston airport.
Okay. That's all right. You are entitled. You are entitled. So if you were tuned in from the beginning of the show, of course, we have a brand new sponsor, but I do want to reiterate the fact that we had the lovely Sarah Lipstate on the phone for this interview. I guess she was on Skype, pardon me, but she is on the show. And if you don't know who Sarah Lipstate is, she is Noveller. And we get into all sorts of amazing in-depth details about not only her career, but touring with the likes of Iggy Pop, which is amazing. And
that's incredible.
Yeah, so I'm prefacing the interview by saying that this is a perfect show to introduce a new sponsor like Pedal Genie onto the show, because Pedal Genie is essentially Netflix for guitar pedals, Chris. And the cool thing is that we're seeing this business model change even as we digest media, or as we go to the movies now from the privacy of our own home. So once I found out about this, in fact, Ryan Ford, who works for Atomic Film and Design, who also sponsored this show, had written in 2014 a little blurb about this company in the U.S. called Pedal Genie. And then lo and behold, here we are doing some business with them. So
That's great, man. Are
you familiar with this company, dude? Have you ever heard of anything like this before?
I read about it a long time ago after Ryan, like chatting with Ryan about it, but it's just one of those things you don't really think about, but it's a really interesting business model. It's kind of a little bit behind where video is went, because it's the original Netflix business model, right?
Sure.
Like they send you a pedal. You can keep it as long as you want, or you can send it back when you're finished. As soon as they receive your other product, you get a new one in the mail, and it's all kind of, you have a lineup that you have listed, and you hope that you get the next one on your lineup, and then you go from there. And I think it's a really rad, I think it's kind of a testament to the way that home-based music production and recording has went. You can sit there as a home engineer or a home experimentalist and like, oh, I know I've got this one coming in, and then it inspires you to write something based around that effect pedal or something. It's a really interesting idea.
You took the thought right out of my brain. Here's the thing. If you are a producer at home, okay, and let's face it, guitar pedals can be pretty expensive. If you are within the same realm of our budget for anything, okay, you rent the pedal to put on a certain record or a few of them at a time, you know, exhaust them. In fact, I shouldn't name the stores that I've done this at, but I have essentially took out loaner gear to sample or put on a record. Then like, oh, yeah, it wasn't my thing, you know, and then you give it back. But this is a legit way to not only subscribe. So what you can do is there are different levels of membership. For like $19.95 a month, you play one pedal at a time. You keep it as long as you want. No contract, no deposit. You ship it back just like that now. Or for $39, okay, one pedal at a time, exchange whenever, all shipping included. First month is free with the second month. Now, if you go to $69, three pedals at a time, exchange whenever, no contract, no deposit. All right, so you can have three pedals from all of the different companies that you and I have talked about endlessly here, including, of course, our friends at Boss, but some of the other, like, I mean, if you look at the brand, okay, so there is a huge number of pedals here, in fact, over 1,800, but the boutique guys, the big guys, everything in between, pedalgenie.com. And I know that we're giving them a little bit of extra love, but I just thought, for a show like Knobs, like, how crazy is it that we've made a connection with a company in the U.S. And that's another thing to reiterate, they are a U.S. only company, but Pedal Genie, custom designed for a show like this. What do you think?
I think it's great, man, and you know, it'll be interesting to see how it progresses, if we can get some of the trade cross-border trade agreements in place, and if they can maybe start shipping to Canada.
Yeah, it'd be great.
It would be a real, or you know, maybe have the infrastructure set up so they can ship to Canada. But it's a really cool service for the U.S. That's for damn sure.
Yeah, I agree. And based on the agreement that we've got, and I don't mind saying it on the show, they're going to sign on and sponsor shows with pedal heavy artists. And today's show is a great starting point for that. So let's get into our chat with Sarah Lipstate. She talked to me from her lovely home in L.A. She is actually in Nam, or pardon me, at Nam, not Vietnam, at Nam this weekend, which is that would be really interesting for her. But Nam is the biggest trade show as far as any, essentially within the business of music. So it's obviously it's a trade show when it comes to things like having a booth for your company, but all sorts of educational sessions. Demos and things like that. And Sarah Lipstate, also known as Noveller, is doing some demos for pedal companies at NAMM this weekend. So I thought it was a really great time to talk to her. And she has a brand new album, which is called A Pink Sunset for No One. It is set to be released on February 10th, which is amazing. And I'm really, really excited to have a chat with her. I just thought that she was such an ideal, you know, an ideal guest for a show like Knobs. She is kind of like a Brooklyn-based guitarist who makes LA her home now, and I urge everybody, not only is she a pretty face, some really, really, really pretty music, and of course, I'm not being, sexist by any means. It's just a really neat story to see a lovely lady who is a one-woman band doing her thing, opening for some really big acts, getting a name for herself, and becoming somewhat of a household name for all the right reasons. So I'm real happy.
And collaborating with a lot of people too. Like, I had no idea she had done some work with Lee Ronaldo, who, you know, tying back to some of our earlier guests. It's really cool to see and hear some of these collaborations. And she's a really interesting artist. It's ambient noise and film score type stuff. It's visual. It's great, man.
Yeah, good point. She's a filmmaker as well at an earlier point in her career too. But she's just really candid, down to earth. And this has been a long time in the making, this episode. So I think it's about that time. Why don't we toss over to my chat on Skype with the lovely Sarah Lipstate, also known as Noveller, right here on this episode of Knobs. How are you?
I am doing pretty well.
Are you tired? Is that what you're trying to tell me?
A little bit. A little tired, but I'm feeling good. It's actually a beautiful day here today. It like rained all day yesterday, and that was, you know, it kind of put a somber mood on things, so it helps to be at least have like the sunshine pouring in through my windows while I'm waking up, you know, drinking my coffee. So
where are you right now? Where am I talking to you from?
I'm in Los Angeles now.
I'm in Canada, so I'm looking outside at like snow trucks by and shit. So you're not allowed to complain about rain. Okay.
Yes, that's fine.
It has been a bit of an adventure trying to track you down because you've been so busy lately. So first and foremost,
I know, it's finally a good time because I'm kind of in between the craziness because, you know, the album is out soon, but not quite yet. So it's it's a good time for me.
You're probably one of the more ideal guests for this program that I've been trying to track down. I mean, we talk about gear and look at your setup, and I've followed your career for a long time. So I'm really happy that you decided to do this. So I did want to ask about your childhood, and we're going to get to the brand new album and all sorts of things in between.
All right.
But when you talk about being on downtime right now in LA, what are you in the midst of in your life right now? Is it just doing promo and press and stuff?
Yes, it's a lot of press, you know, a lot of interviews so far talking about the album and also, you know, the touring in the U.S. is going to start in March. And so my booking agent's still, you know, putting that together. So it's a lot of logistical planning. Because, you know, it's doing press for the album is one thing, but, you know, the touring is really the important aspect and what really gets people excited about the album, you know, hearing some of the songs live. And another part of that is me getting my set prepared. And, you know, since I created the music for this album, my gear has changed so much. You know, I have welcomed some new guitars into my stable, and so it's going to be interesting for me to work out how that's gonna change the sound and how I want to present this music in the live environment. So that's all what's in the forefront of my mind at the moment.
Does that shit keep you up at night, all night, every night?
No, it's what makes me excited about getting up in the morning. You know, I was just messing around. That's the thing that has been a distraction lately is, I'll just get ideas in my head about what I want to do with the guitar, and has nothing to do with the album or like the songs I'm supposed to be rehearsing. And so I spent like 3 or 4 hours yesterday, like finger picking this it's supposed to be this kind of like polyrhythmic melody that I came up with. And so I got really excited about that. It's like, I didn't do any finger picking on the album, maybe like one song, but it has like nothing to do with what I'm supposed to be preparing.
Yeah, but who's going to give you a trouble for it, though? You don't get in shit for stuff like that. I mean, this is why you do what you do, right?
Yes. So it's fun, but also, I need to switch back into rehearsal mode at some point. But that's what was fun for me yesterday. And, you know, my fingers got pretty beat up after doing that for 3 or 4 hours. And so, I took a break in the evening and then went to bed. And so I wake up in the morning and I'm excited. Like first thing, I'm like checking my fingers. It's like, okay, am I ready to start playing again today with like fresh hands? And so
have you ever had to take a day off? Do you look at your hands ever and go, oh, I can't play today? Or do you muscle through it? You tough it out?
No, it usually, I feel like I'm still at the point where my body's pretty resilient. I traveled. All right. I like traveled by car from Los Angeles to Lafayette, Louisiana for the holidays.
Wow.
Where my family, all my family is based there, and I wanted to bring my dog and my cat, so I decided to do the drive, and it's like a 25 hours minimum drive
with just your pets. No friends, just you and your dog and your cat,
right?
What are their names? What's your dog and cat's name?
My dog, her name is Sai, and my cat's name is Safi.
Nice.
And they are both accustomed to road trips with me. They don't like it really, but they've been forced to do it for a while. So anyway, you know, I also brought my new Les Paul with me and like one pedal board and all this stuff. But I did. So, you know, I had to stop two nights and stay in hotels and like bring all my stuff in. And I did kind of like overextend my wrist trying to carry. I like piled all this stuff on top of my cat's litter box and I thought I could like carry it in, and my wrist bent back and it was sore for a few days, but it was my right hand. So I was like, oh, it doesn't, you know, my right hand, all it has to do is like the picking. So I still played, but yeah, barring injuries, I feel like nothing really keeps me from playing every day if I want to.
I was going to say,
you know, have the time.
If that's what sidelined you, you need to create a better story as to what what happened. You know, I mean, your cat and dog are part of the family anyway. But next time, make it like a bar fight or something that's a little bit more, elaborate. You talk about going home, and how was your holiday? It's funny every time that I'm doing an interview, I have to ask people, how was the holiday? Happy New Year, all that great stuff. How's the family?
It went pretty well. I was there for 10 days, and it was the holidays, so people tend to
gorge.
Put aside maybe differences in political opinions allow everyone to kind of come together and enjoy just being all in the same place and, eating food, drinking wine. So it went well. I was happy that
that you didn't punch anyone?
I did not. So that was a success.
Good. It's funny how I am in Canada and I can feel the tension from my friends and the people that I talk to in the U.S. Because let's face it, family's family, and our beliefs are, they're not always going to lock in. They're not always going to be in sync, right? So I'm sure that your beliefs might vary from any of the family. But for Christmas, you got to get together and everyone just has to kind of, be on the surface and talk talk about your life and your career and how everything is going. So I'm glad that you got through it. And
yeah, thank you.
Now, you're from Birmingham originally, are you not?
Well, I was born in Birmingham, but my family relocated to Louisiana when I was 2 years old. So Louisiana is really where I grew up and spent, all my formative years. So that's where I go when, you know, when I visit family is Louisiana.
Would that make you a Southern Belle? Does that make sense? Is that what deep
I
says?
Definitely had aspects of that in my childhood. I do not currently identify as a Southern Belle, but it's a part of my upbringing. I mean, we being in Louisiana as a child, my parents had me join a Mardi Gras crew.
Right.
So every year for Mardi Gras, you know, these crazy sequined embroidered gowns were created for me that I had to wear.
Oh,
and
wow.
We would, you know, the fun part was we got to ride on a float for the parade, the children's parade. And so you got to, you know, be on the float and throw Mardi Gras beads and doubloons out to the people, you know, who came to the parade. And that was fun. But there's definitely this other aspect to it where there would be the evening where you would, it was like in an auditorium. So everyone, all the family members are like seated out in the audience and you have to walk around the stage and you're like presenting yourself to the audience. And so you have to go and you have to stop and you have to curtsy.
Weird.
And it's a weird thing. And, I was also in cotillion, which is like where, when I was in middle school, so I wasn't even a teenager yet, but that's like where they teach you how to dance,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Like all different dances. And so like, you know, the guys have to come over and ask you to dance.
Oh,
and
that shit,
like
that must haunt you now. That must mess you up a little bit. You don't strike me as being that type of person who likes to be paraded and presented.
Oh, no.
You know?
Like, no, I'm not. But that's a part of, you know, the culture that I was raised in. And it's, it's crazy to talk about it now.
Yeah, that's crazy.
But it's interesting because if you've seen the artwork,
mm-hmm.
For
the new record,
the new album,
yeah,
A Pink Sunset for No One. It's my image is on the cover. It's like my face, and then there's this blue painted gown that I'm wearing.
Right.
And John Foster, who he created the album artwork, said he was inspired by me talking about my Mardi Gras gowns because this past August in Louisiana, there was a huge flood,
mm-hmm.
that it hit the city Lafayette, where my family lives, Baton Rouge, Denham Springs. I mean, it was a big part of southern Louisiana was flooded. And my grandmother, her house is on the river, and her house got like 4 feet of water in it. And so of that, we had to go and, you know, help like tear out all the carpet and everything. And it just so happened that my sister and my, all of our Mardi Gras gowns from our childhood were stored there. And so we had to like rescue the Mardi Gras gowns out of like this flooded room.
I thought you were going to say they went floating by. So as you're like,
no,
trying to...
they didn't go floating by. They were, they only got a little bit of water damage, but I was posting some video. I posted a photo of one of my gowns that had this crazy embroidered unicorn on it, and you could see some of the water. And so John said he was inspired by seeing this to create that image, you know, kind mm-hmm. of like combining the flood with like the, you know, the blue color brush strokes with this gown. And so he was kind of incorporating that part of my history into the artwork in a way that, you know, the average person wouldn't necessarily connect.
Yeah, it came full circle. So a piece of your childhood,
yes,
is now part of your present day life and this brand new record, which is amazing.
Yep.
That's awesome.
Yes.
You know, it's funny that you bring up New Orleans because I've been talking to my wife about this for the past little while. I actually listened to another podcast that it's called Beyond Bourbon Street. This guy named Mark Bologna, he does this a New Orleans podcast. And I dream about New Orleans all the time. And not
really?
Yeah, it's weird. It's like these old Victorian mansions in the Garden District come into my dreams all the time. There's this romantic notion of the lamps and the old architecture and all that kind of stuff. Like, I'm not into the whole Bourbon Street, Mardi Gras, show me your,
yeah,
you know, like
the party.
That's not really, maybe I'm just an old fart now, but when it comes to things like that, I've already been there and done that in every single city that I could possibly imagine anyway. But
yeah.
I didn't know about that. And my first question was to talk about your childhood, but you kind of summed it up for me right there within that little story, which is really cool. But tell me about, you know, music plays such a huge part of New Orleans and its history there. Tell me about early on for music for you. I know you were a piano player when you were a little girl as well, and then some brass. Mm-hmm. But how did music make its way into your life?
Well, it's interesting because even though I'm from a place that has a rich history of music, I didn't grow up with music in my house. My parents' musical tastes are as far from mine as you can get. Like, my dad is a huge Jimmy Buffett fan. And so the only time we...
He's a parrot head?
Yeah.
He's a parrot head.
So the only time we would listen to music would be on like family road trips if we were driving to Florida to go to the beach for a vacation or something like that.
And you know that that's where they all congregate, right? It's like Margaritaville is Florida.
I don't think my dad has ever been to a Jimmy Buffett concert, but he has all of his CDs.
How does that make you feel? Are you okay with it? Because my dad wears a bandana from time to time. Do you know what a bandana is? For real. Like some dads wear like a leather jacket or something, and they're doing their best to try to like fit in. My dad wears a Hawaiian shirt from time to time, or he has a bandana. So if your dad's a parrot head, he has to have an innate fashion sense.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know. I just really hated the music.
it's cheesy, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's a little cheesy. That's okay. You can say
it. What he liked about it was he always said he liked that Jimmy Buffett can't really sing. Like, he has a crappy voice, but he managed to carve out a niche for himself and be extremely successful.
He sure did.
By, you know, making fun music. And like, no one in my family can sing. Like, we all have horrible voices. So I think my dad identified, you know, just like really liked that. But so the music that I was brought up with was like Jimmy Buffett. We had like this CD that was just a mixture of different Broadway songs. So like songs from Cats and Guys and Dolls, and then we had the Back to the Future soundtrack.
Yes,
and
that's
Forrest
amazing.
Gump soundtrack.
The Back to the Future soundtrack has The Power of Love by Huey Lewis and the News, which is one of the best. This is one of the best songs of all time. It also has, I think, there's like Johnny Be Good, and I had that on cassette. That's a part of my life as well. Yeah, I get it.
Yeah, so those were like the rotating
soundtrack
albums
to your life.
Yeah. The soundtrack to my childhood. But it was also, I remember the night that it was, I don't know why it was hidden away, but the night that I discovered, or that my dad revealed his vinyl collection, which was modest, because as I said, he was not like a big music person, but it was like this cabinet that I never looked inside before. He opened it one day and there was his turntable and these vinyl albums. Cause we had been watching one of the Muppet movies, like the Great Muppet Caper or something.
Oh, yeah.
Cause we were kids.
Yeah.
And so my dad had the like John Denver Plays with the Muppets album on
vinyl. I have that record. It's awesome.
So he took it out and played it for us. And I was like, why have I never seen this machine before? Why have I never seen these like vinyl discs before? And I got obsessed with it. He also had, you know, some Beatles albums, and he had Holst Plays the Planets. So those were the albums that I really gravitated towards. But that was what got me fascinated with this format of music, with vinyl. And he ended up giving me his record player. And then when I was a little bit older, like, you know, when I became a teenager, I was able to start buying my own records. So basically what I'm saying is my parents played a role in my discovery of music, but they didn't really impart any like taste or love for, you know, for music.
They had the car, but they didn't drive you directly there,
yeah,
is what you're saying. I get
exactly.
It. The record player is a big deal. The Jimmy Buffett records, not so much, but you know, it's,
right.
Can I ask you how old, I'm not supposed to ask you that. How old are you?
I'm 32.
Okay. So we're relatively within, like I'm 36. So the 80s and growing up in that time, it's pretty fucking crazy to think back of my childhood and how music has shaped who I am today and what, you know, even my musical tastes and stuff. Because like, do you remember the first concert that your parents ever took you? Did you ever go to shows when you were a kid?
Yeah, we went when I was in fourth grade. We went to see the Beach Boys and America opened for
Nice.
Them.
Wow. So what was the lineup of the Beach Boys? It was probably like Mike Love and then like three other dudes wearing those stupid shirts or something.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Basically. I don't remember that much from it, except that we were sitting up like really high.
Yeah.
You know, like we didn't have great seats.
but it's still magical, right? Those moments when you think back, wasn't that so larger than life and crazy for you as a kid to see that? You know, that must resonate with you now, especially being on stage as opposed to being in the audience, you know, back in the day. That's amazing.
It does.
Let's talk about how you became actually playing music, of course, part of touring bands and things like One Umbrella, Sands, Parts and Labor. Mm-hmm. And now you're doing your own thing. How did you first begin to do what you're doing right now?
Well, when I was... So kind of like my entree into more like the music that really started to resonate with me was through, you know, music that I heard on the radio, because that's how I learned about music. And it was like in bands that were on the radio who did covers of the more underground bands that influenced them. So like, I heard a cover of Where Is My Mind? And I was like, oh, well, this song is written by this band called the Pixies. What's that all about?
Yeah.
Or like, you know, the cover of a Talking Heads song. And so through like a mainstream channel, I was able to access music that you wouldn't hear.
Who was doing the Pixies cover, though? Was it like Switchfoot or someone like that?
No, it was I was really into this band from the Dallas-Fort Worth area called the Toadies.
Yeah, dude, they're great. Toadies, yeah, they're awesome.
Yeah,
yeah, they're
so
great.
You know, they would play their song Possum Kingdom on the radio all the time, and I loved it. And it just so happened that they, you know, we're a super cool band, and so they would cover Where Is My Mind in their live show. And they also did a cover of Not in Love by the Talking Heads. And then also I was like really active on their music forum on their website. So just like talking to other fans of the band.
Yeah.
It was like how I found out about a lot of post-punk music and just like really cool stuff that I got really deep into. So then like once you realize that there's this whole that there's so much music out there that, you know, you just don't hear it on the radio or on MTV, then you can start navigating those channels necessary to, you know, learn more about that type of music. So I got really into the Pixies and Sonic Youth and Talking Heads.
Nice.
And it just so happened that those three bands had a female member.
Mm-hmm.
And so I started looking to Kim Gordon, Kim Deal, and Tina Weymouth as my role models, even though they were all bass players and I really wanted to play the guitar. I still felt inspired by them. So I think like when I was 16 was when I really started talking to my parents about, you know, like, oh, for Christmas, I'd really like to get a guitar or whatever. And they like just weren't they didn't really get on board. So
what were they hoping that you would, they were hoping you were going to do something else, I guess?
It was just like, you know, they were the ones who initiated the piano lessons starting when I was in second grade.
Right.
I think that was my mom's idea of like how I should be trained. And then they decided when I starting in sixth grade that I was going to join the band, the school band, mm-hmm. you know, and play an instrument. But then like when I came home and said that the instrument I had chosen was the trombone, they were like, oh, are you sure you want to play that instrument? You know, it's really big and like, maybe did you try out one of the woodwind instruments or whatever? And so I've always kind of gravitated towards maybe not the most traditional pick for a young woman, but you know, I said, that's the instrument I thought was really cool. And I think I'm going to be good at it. And I was. And so they bought me a trombone. They bought me two trombones. You know,
wow.
You start out with like the crappy student model, and then you have to shell out like thousands of dollars for the pro model. And I mean, I was first chair trombone, so I wasn't like fucking around,
yeah.
You know, they knew that I was committed. But I think when I presented them with this other instrument, I mean, I don't know. There's just like mild resistance, but
do you know when I think about this moment when you tell them about the guitar, I hear the trombone going wah, wah.
The sad trombone.
yeah,
I should have had the trombone in hand.
That
should have
been, yeah, it's so key. So when I told my parents I wanted to play guitar,
they did. I mean, to their credit, they did buy me a used Yamaha acoustic guitar, I think, like the Christmas when I was 16.
Okay.
But they didn't know that I would like that deep in my heart, like I just wanted an electric guitar so I could make feedback like Sonic Youth. So I found the acoustic guitar to be pretty disappointing, you know. And of course we're all ungrateful, like
the first
little
guitar
brats when we're 16 years old. But anyway, I thought it was a good opportunity to start figuring out, you know, how you hold down the strings and like play chords or whatever. But I got a summer job when I was 17 and saved up the money to buy my first electric guitar. And that's when I really started playing, you know, going down the path of like playing the guitar in the way that was interesting to me.
Mm-hmm. And what was it? What was your first guitar that you went out and bought for yourself?
Well, it was the cheapest one that they had at the music shop that I was working at, which was this periwinkle color Dan Electra.
Oh, I love those. Those are awesome. It's like two knobs.
Yeah, the lipstick pickups.
Yes, yeah. I had a purple one. I had like a violet, a really light purple one. Which is
that's probably the same color.
Yeah, it's like,
I mean, mine was kind of like a blue,
yeah,
purplish
bluey
color, and
I had
it was the cheapest one. I think it was like $217.
Yeah, and the headstock was blue too, and it was like,
yes.
Yeah, like the entire neck and the headstock was all one piece, and it was like the entire thing. I had that guitar. That was, yeah, that's crazy.
Right on.
And the outside, the knobs were like, they were like inlay. So there was a knob on the outside and then one on the inside, and they were like, that's crazy. I had that guitar.
Mm-hmm.
See, we're connecting. This is a good thing.
Yes.
So when we talk about the guitar, now you've reached at, you know, the point that you've got the weapon of your choice here.
Mm-hmm.
How do you connect with other people that are doing the same thing? When do you become, you know, a rocker?
Yeah, there was no one to connect with in Lafayette, Louisiana when I was 17 years old. Like, my circle of friends were not interested in the same type of music that I was interested in. So playing the guitar was very much like a solitary activity. I'd come home from school and lock myself in my bedroom and listen to Sonic Youth records and Pavement records and just, you know, play guitar.
Mm-hmm.
And so it wasn't until I moved away. I moved to Austin, Texas and went to college at UT. And that was when I met other people who had the same interests as me. And that's when I started playing with other people. And that's when my world kind of opened up.
And then at some point after that, you ended up in Brooklyn, didn't you?
Yeah, as soon as so I graduated from UT December of 2006, and I landed in Brooklyn, New York on January 3rd, 2007.
Like Williamsburg or something?
In Greenpoint.
I was just there last summer. I love it there. Greenpoint
is amazing.
Excellent. Yeah, it's beautiful.
Mm-hmm. Greenpoint is great. So I had secured a month-long sublet in Greenpoint, and I brought one guitar and one suitcase. And my parents were like, you know, we'll support this, this vision of yours. You know, let's say we'll set a month of time. You go up there and you try to find a job. And if you can find a job, then, you know, that'll allow you to find an apartment and everything. So why don't you try it out? And so that's what I did. And, you know, it was like 3 weeks of applying to every job on Craigslist that I felt like I qualified for as a recent college graduate. And I finally found a job like towards the very end of my month there. And so then I found an apartment and blah, blah, blah. The rest is history. But yeah, the reason I wanted to move up there is because I had this duo, kind of like experimental guitar synth duo when I was in college, and we played the CMJ Music Festival in New York in October of 2006. And my friend who plays in Bearer in Heaven let us stay at his apartment in Williamsburg for a week, and my band One Umbrella played two shows, and I was just like, this is the place. If I want to pursue music, this is the place I want to be.
Yeah.
So being in Brooklyn, playing two shows there is what inspired me to make that leap. And yeah. And then I spent almost 10 years of my life, you know, in Brooklyn, working jobs and playing music and, you know, building my career.
I mean, other than maybe Austin or fucking Nashville, what other city would have been more custom designed for somebody that's a young, ambitious musician? In that community, you just see everybody is exactly like you. Isn't that such a wonderful vibe there? You know, as far as music goes and things like, I got that vibe. I mean, I went down to see a friend play a couple of shows, and I stayed at an Airbnb, and maybe I looked like the sore thumb, you know, walking around, but I felt like I was amongst my own people there, because I fucking hate when people say hipsters. I don't mean like that, but I mean like people that are young and hungry to live life on their own terms and be creative in music. And it sounds like that's exactly what you found when you were there.
Yeah. What I liked about it, like what turned me off about Austin, where I, you know, lived while I was in college, which there's a very rich musical scene there, but in Brooklyn, people are more motivated because it's a pain in the ass to live there. It's so expensive. It's hard to make it there. Right. It's hard. Austin, it's a very much more laid back environment. It's really easy to live there. So you can become a slacker. Mm-hmm. And I really liked the drive that New Yorkers had. Even if you're in the music industry where, you know, whatever, you're making rock and roll or whatever you're doing, you're motivated because if you don't work your ass off, you're not going to be able to afford your rent and you're going to have to move back in with your parents.
Yeah, the night. Cue the trombone sound right there. There it is right there. If you're there and you're – I love that band Bear in Heaven. Were you friends with any of the guys in Grizzly Bear as well? Did you meet any of those guys out there?
Yeah, I met Daniel
Rawson.
And maybe Chris also.
He's been on the show before. We had Chris. We had Chris Taylor on the show before. He's awesome.
Yeah.
And
My roommate, my first roommate, Meg. When I got my first apartment in Greenpoint, we moved in together and she got connected with those guys. And so it was kind of cool because I remember Daniel was over at the apartment the night. It was before Grizzly Bear hit it really big, but they were still known, but they were on, I think it was on Letterman. It might've been Conan, but I think they were on Letterman, and they were backing up Feist. Yeah, so like we went to the bar and I think we all watched it together and he was embarrassed because, you know, they were just like they had to wear these funny gloves or something and whatever. And so it was an interesting time. You know, I didn't get to know them very well, but they were kind of like a part of my orbit for a period of time. And I think they're incredible musicians. I mean, super talented guys.
Yeah, they pop up on this show from time to time, just even through talking to other artists. But I know that once you brought up Baron Heaven, I remember Ed told me about that band a long time ago. And then I'm a big fan. Those guys got great mustaches in that band.
Yeah.
In Baron Heaven. So we go from there, and now you get the call from Parts and Labor. You end up playing with them for a little bit as well. When did you decide that you wanted to break out onto your own? When did you say, no, I'm going to do it all on my own?
Well, it wasn't so much my own decision. I was always doing Novella on this side when I was involved like in Parts and Labor. Mm-hmm. I even opened for Parts and Labor. Oh, remember weird. A show we did at Union Pool in Brooklyn. So I was always doing Novella. After I left Parts and Labor, I got asked to join Cold Cave during a very pivotal part of their Ascent. I only played with them for 2 months, but during those 2 months is when they signed to Matador. So I got to have that whole experience of like going to the Matador offices and like see them like sign the contract and get treated to fancy dinner and drinks and stuff like that.
And you were a Pavement fan too, so that must have been exciting to see.
Of course.
Like what fucking band don't we love that is on Matador? I mean,
seriously. Yeah. I mean, even like, Dinosaur Jr. Yep. It's on Matador now, but
amazing.
Yeah, that was a big deal. But then I got kicked out of that band.
What'd you do?
It's just how Wes runs the band. It's his vision, and I think the supporting cast of musicians he just views as something that changes and evolves.
I get it.
So I think they decided, just as easily as they decided they wanted a guitar player, they decided they didn't want a guitar player. And so if you look at the Wikipedia for that band under past members, it's like probably a giant paragraph at this point. Yeah, so I'm just one of a few people who've been kicked out.
am I mistaken? Is that just a two-piece band normally now?
Now it is, yeah.
But didn't he do something with like Dominic Furnow at one point as well?
Dominic was in the band at the same time that I was in the band.
So you get kicked out of the band. So you get kicked out of that band. Or when does it become the main course for you?
Well, shortly after I got kicked out of Cold Cave, I got asked to go on tour supporting the Jesus Lizard for their reunion shows.
Oh, wow.
And cool. I did 4 dates opening for them. So I figured if I was getting asked to do stuff like that, then it gave me the confidence to immerse myself full time into Novella.
Yeah.
And luckily it was around the same time that I stopped playing with Cold Cave because I think I really needed that confidence. So that was how it happened.
So when that happens, then you're like, okay, this isn't just a fluke. I'm going to do this. I'm going to go, kind of full time on my own. That has to be a very empowering feeling for you.
Oh yeah.
And let alone, it would be silly for me to not point out that empowerment as far as being a woman in this industry, mm-hmm. in this industry surrounded by disgusting men all over the place and fucking egos. And, mm-hmm. Tell me about what does that feel like to you to be someone that is so independent as far as being not only like the only person in your band at this point, but being a woman in the industry. What does that speak for you?
It feels like I'm in a powerful position. You know, I'm in control of my schedule and, to some extent, the direction I want to move my career in and my pursuit. And I feel like I have the opportunity to be a role model for other women who are maybe interested in pursuing music, but they haven't maybe seen a woman on stage by themselves before. Mm-hmm. And I just try to keep the perspective of you know, how I felt when I was a young girl and I was knew what I wanted to do, but I didn't have a roadmap to follow. Mm-hmm. And I feel like it's very exciting for me to, you know, be in the position to some extent to contribute to, a path for women of a younger generation to follow. And I mean, that's badass.
You must have women or girls come up to you after every show saying that they just probably feel so much more empowered by you, or that they're in awe of you.
Yeah, it's always nice when that happens. Or like if women ask me questions about, you know, how they can do it, or, you know, just I feel really privileged to be in the position to help them out or give them advice, answer questions, or just even to hear them say, like, thank you. You know, I definitely treasure those moments.
Yeah, that's amazing. You did a tour with, did you open for St. Vincent at one point as well?
Yeah, we did. I got to support her on her North American tour. It was in 2014. We did like Toronto and Vancouver. And I actually just ran into her here in Los Angeles. She's been living here pretty much for the past year. And, you know, it was like a huge opportunity for me. And again, she asked me to do the tour because she and David Byrne were at a concert that I played in New York City, and they mm-hmm. saw me perform. And so, you know, obviously she saw me perform and then decided that it would be cool to have me support her on her tour. So that was really great. But obviously she's ascended to completely new heights since then. You know, that album we were touring on, she won the Grammy for, but she has her own signature guitar now.
Right.
With Ernie Ball. And, you know, she was, you know, I was a fan of hers before we toured together. And I continue to be a fan and to be inspired by her. So it was cool that, you know, that as a woman that she saw me and decided that she wanted to bring me into, you know, kind of like her circle, because I think that's really important as women that we try and support other women who are in our industry. Mm-hmm. It doesn't always happen. So, in terms of like the people who have helped me in my career, she, you know, is definitely a very badass and powerful woman who has lent me, you know, a hand by giving me more exposure and, that opportunity. So I really, respect and admire her for doing that.
Yeah. More so to that point, I don't want you to think that I was simply bringing that up to like name drop someone else that you've been on tour with. I just thought, if you're thinking of this girl power movement, and I don't mean that cheesy, I mean as an empowering movement, who better than to go out on tour with than someone like St. Vincent? How awesome is that?
Right.
You know, from a spectator's standpoint, to go like, holy shit, the opener is this solo, you know, this beautiful solo woman who's doing this, you know, what she's doing. And then St. Vincent comes out and just melts everybody's faces anyway. I think that's so awesome.
She's such an amazing guitar player and performer. And, you know, I think we did something like 27 shows together. I think it was something like that. With the whole tour, I was gone from my home for 41 days tour. So I really, you know, absorbed a lot from watching her.
Very cool.
And, you know, we're lucky to have women like her, you know, be successful. I mean, you know, it's, she was on the most recent cover of Guitar World magazine. And, I think that's just really cool for women to see, or for like girls who are interested in playing guitar, they can pick this St. Vincent custom guitar that's specifically designed with women's bodies in mind, you know. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. It's like we haven't had that before. So she's making it better.
Okay, so I know that you're probably in a hurry. I don't want to keep you for much longer, but I do okay. have so I have a couple things that I have to get across here, and of course we can't talk we can't not talk about your gear because it must be evolving all the time. And I did I wanted to bring out the fact that you have been a filmmaker in the past too, because it leans your sound leans so much towards soundtrack stuff. You can see why somebody like me would think about these soundscapes and the music that you make. But it's more important for me to talk about your gear, because I am pondering this question. Do companies send you loads of shit all the time? Does your pedal board evolve all the time? Like, you must, like, ding dong, and it's like the UPS with, like, here's another box full of toys. Does that happen to you?
Yes, but that's been a fairly recent development. I have to say that the first pedal company that reached out to me and sent me a free pedal was it was completely badass, but it was Eventide.
Oh, nice.
And this was years ago. Maybe like 2011, 2010, they reached out to me and they sent me their Space Reverb pedal, which is just, a really expensive pedal, but they were, they were interested in what I was doing, and they thought that I could use, their pedal, put it to good use. And I ended up going to their headquarters in Little Ferry, New Jersey, and shooting a video for them and talking about why I love the reverb pedal and all that stuff. Cool. So that was I have a lot of respect for them, because it was the first company that saw me as an artist that they of value that they could partner with. But yeah, since I've become more active on social media, posting about the gear that I'm into and, getting a big response from people who also care about gear, some pedal companies have realized people are looking to her for her opinion on things. And, maybe I have a different take on it than some of the other people. So I have started getting exciting shipments from companies, and I'm going to be demoing at NAMM coming up very soon for Earthquaker Devices and Red Panda Labs. So, of course, on Friday, I'm getting the super secret new pedals that Earthquaker is going to be premiering. So that's going to be arriving soon, and then I'll get to play with those before the demo at NAMM.
Cool. I've been listening. I went back through the entire catalog as I was, my wife and I just had another baby, and I went back, and this is really good soundtrack music for me to rock my baby to sleep to. So I put in
I can see that. Very cool.
Yeah. And it works so lovely. And I wanted to be kind of prepared. So I did go back all the way from, some of the EP stuff and the split, but I wanted to, I had a couple of questions really quickly.
Yeah.
In studio, have you always mic'd an amp, or do you do DI when it comes to some of the recording stuff as well?
So, the only album that I've actually, I don't know if you would really call it an album, but my very first release, Paint on the Shadows, it was a vinyl only release in 2008. That's the only album I've recorded in an actual studio. So far.
Oh, so you do it all on your own?
Yeah. And so for the subsequent albums, Desert Fryers and Glacial Glow, I recorded them at home on my own, but I did mic my amp.
Oh, okay.
And then starting with No Dreams, I started recording direct because I think I kind of had to out of necessity. I didn't really have a dedicated rehearsal space where I could play loudly, but that's how I've recorded all of the albums since No Dreams. And I mean, now that I'm in Los Angeles and I'm meeting all these amazing engineers and producers, I'm starting to think man, would it be really awesome to record the next album in a studio and, get to play with different amps and miking and, have an engineer who really knows what they're doing help me out. Mm-hmm. So I'm starting to think about that as a possibility.
Yeah, I just hear the tonal quality of some of this stuff as it progresses through the albums. That was something that I was wondering right off the bat. I'm like, how is she getting that sound that has to be Dion? But it's amazing, and every one of them is so different. Right up to this brand new record, but the first single from it is a pretty big departure from some of the other stuff that you've done, Trails and Trials, I guess. But
yes.
So a Pink Sunset for No One, the brand new record. How has this been any different than? And I know that's such a broad question, but does this one stand out next to the rest of your library for any specific reasons?
I think all of my albums make sense if you view it as, you know, like the evolution of my project. Mm-hmm. I don't think any particular one is a drastic departure, you know. With the new album, of course the guitar is the main star of the compositions. Sonically, there are some different, I don't know, I get really excited. There's one track on the album, the new album called Lone Victory Tonight, that is, it's all guitar. And there's so many diverse sounds on that track. I'm really proud of myself. but a big part of that is, so I had pre-ordered the Electroharmonix Mel 9 Mellotron pedal while I was on the Iggy tour. And so when I got home from the US dates, it was waiting for me. Wow. And so I started using it and recording it for some of the new songs for the album. And so you hear like the Mellotron, like the flute sound or the cello sound or the horn sound. And I'm manipulating it. I'm like doing bowed, distorted flute Mellotron.
Wow.
It's crazy. It's really fun.
What track is that called? Which one is that called again?
Lone Victory Tonight.
Okay. All right. I'm going to mark that down.
Yeah, and like I play this, I don't know. It's just, it's really fun. And so I kind of tried to carry, since it is kind of a different sound, I tried to repeat it, like the closing track, Emergence. I bring back some of the same Mellotron sound, the Mel 9 sounds. Mm-hmm. So that way it doesn't like really stick out. So, you know, I feel like as long as the album, like the tracks are all inhabit the same world of the album, then it's easier to view it, to like kind of pan out and view it within my larger catalog. Mm-hmm. So it's like if the album makes sense unto itself, then it'll have a better place within within the entirety of my work. So that's kind of how I view it.
You brought up Iggy. Let's talk about some other quick, really holy shit moments for you. Was that probably, was that one of the more surreal moments in your career?
Oh, yeah. When I got the phone call from my booking agent, I was freaking out.
Yeah, like what do you even, what do you do then?
you start working on your set immediately.
Yeah, drink. I just start drinking right away. That's fucking crazy. Iggy Pop. Like, and then how many dates did you do with those guys?
I did 12 in the US and 5 in Europe.
Oh man. So how do you top that? What was another, like, what was, would you say other than Iggy Pop, what was another one of those moments for you?
Aside from that tour?
Yeah, yeah. Like, I mean, what can you even put up next to touring with Iggy?
Oh, man. Honestly, the only other time I've been that excited is it was in 2005, and I got asked to play guitar in Rhys Chatham's Guitar Army for a Table of the Elements festival.
Right.
And at that point, I mean, you know, I love the guitar, and I was hugely inspired by Glenn Branca and Rhys Chatham's compositions for, you know, guitar ensembles. And so getting asked to like play with one of my heroes was awesome.
Yeah,
you know,
crazy.
I remember having that same like jumping up and down excitement inside of me. I've had a lot of moments where I've met people, musicians that had a huge impact on on my on my development and like on my childhood, and you know, getting to speak with them as like a peer to some extent, or getting to work with them. And so I feel like, you know, those are the moments that I really treasure, because it just shows how far you can come in a relatively short span of time if you have that passion in you and you have the drive and the dedication to pursue what makes you happy or what you feel like you need to do in life. Mm-hmm. And those are the most validating things, like having Iggy Pop tell you that he loves what you do. I mean, that gives you so much personal validation that as an artist who is self-employed, self-driven, like we rarely get that type of validation from, you know, society or from anyone. Sometimes people don't even get that from their parents. Right. So it's like, I just hold that so dear. And yeah, it's incredible.
Well, if you get it from Iggy, you're doing okay.
Yeah, right.
Well, you know, I'm so honored to have finally connected with you. Congratulations on the new album. And your story is so inspiring. You know, you don't even have to be a woman to you know, it's just amazing.
Yeah. Thank you.
In the career and how everything has shaped up to where it is right now. When does the brand new album drop? What is the exact release date for it?
February 10th.
And are you excited? What will happen after that? How many dates? What do you need now?
I don't know the exact touring schedule yet, but it's going to begin in March in the U.S. And I can't wait. Yeah, I'm so excited to have this album out there. So, yeah, I'm feeling good about it.
Please come back to us in Toronto. I would love to meet you in person. That would be great.
That will happen. Right. I promise.
All right. I look forward to it. Happy New Year and congratulations on everything. And I can't thank you enough for talking to us today.
A happy New Year to you, too. It's been a pleasure. Thanks.
So there you have it. The lovely Miss Sarah Lipstate. How great of an interview was that? She is so down to earth, real candid, you know, talking about the childhood thing right up to the tours with St. Vincent, Iggy Pop, her pedal collection. Hell, even her dog and her cat made their way onto the show. This is a little bit of a bucket list interview for me and an ideal guest for a show like this. Also mentioned in the show, the fact that she is at NAMM this weekend. NAMM is the National Association of Music Merchants. It's essentially a great big trade show for music geeks, including a whole bunch of companies that we've talked about right here on this show. I mean, let's face it, it is a music trade show for musicians and dealers alike, and Sarah Lipstate will be doing some demos on behalf of some companies like Earthquaker Devices and a whole bunch of great stuff like that. But you can go check out the NAMM website as well, www.namm.org, if you would like to connect with her this weekend as she's doing some demos at NAMM, which is really exciting. Once again, I do want to thank our good friends at AtomicFilmShop.com. They are also the people that are responsible for not only uploading the show to iTunes for us, but they've also provided our great website over at KnobsPodcast.com, all right? And our brand new sponsor who hopped on board for a show like today, Pedal Genie. Pedal Genie is the closest thing to Netflix, only for guitar pedals. And again, if you live in the USA, you should visit pedalgenie.com for your shot at renting over 1,800 different pedals and everything that you need for one low monthly fee. Thank you very much to our good friends at Pedal Genie. My good friend Tony over at Pedal Genie has agreed to come on board and sponsor the shows that he feels might be a little bit more suitable for artists that use a whole bunch of different guitar pedals. And I mean, like Noveller, Sarah Lipstate, probably an ideal example of an artist that uses a hell of a lot of guitar pedals, a custom designed show for a sponsor like PedalGenie.com. Looking forward to next week already. Next week, we are going to introduce a new element to the show, and it is as simple as this. We are going to begin to highlight some artists that may not necessarily be the great big names who are signed to a major label, but we're speaking about some artists that, although you might be able to find them on, say, Spotify or online, these are artists that I certainly feel deserve a spotlight and your ears. Let's put it this way. I'm not going to highlight any artist or band on the show that I don't personally listen to or that I haven't got into, per se. Now, I've been working very closely with a select group of not only agencies who have a great roster of, well, bands that you and I love, But I find that a podcast is also a fantastic way for us to not only get to hear some music, but to get to know some of the bands that might not have a shot at, well, let's say, radio. And if you listen to the show, you know my connection with things like that. So that being said, next week I am going to introduce to you a couple of artists that I'm really excited to have on the show. One of them being a lovely singer-songwriter by the name of Molly Birch. And Molly actually has a brand new record. She is an LA writer and producer. She's just got a really, really cool story, and she moved to Austin, Texas. And, you know, we'll get into all the details as far as her background, but she's got a brand new record that is set for release, and it is called Please Be Mine. And straight up, her people reached out to me and said, would you like a copy of the record? You have an opportunity to interview her. Would you like to get to know Molly Birch? I listened to the record, and it was a no-brainer for me, and I'm real confident that you are going to dig Molly Birch. So we're going to have a nice little interview with Molly. Plus, if that's not enough, we are going to have a quick candid chat with the frontman of a fantastic band from Rochester, New York, called Maybird. His name is Josh Netsky. He has a brother that is in the band as well, and the best way to describe this is psychedelic rock and roll. So it's a really great example of a band that I think probably uses not only some cool vintage gear, we get talking about some of that stuff too, but they just got a great story. And yet another one of these artists that have moved to Brooklyn, New York, and they are doing great things. So I'm going to urge you to go and check out Maybird's music. They have a fantastic EP that has already been released. It's called Turning Into Water. And I'll leave it at this. If the band was decent enough to get signed by Danger Mouse and his label 30th Century Records, they are surely good enough to hang out with us right here on Knobs. So I'm really excited. Next week, we have a new segment where we are going to get to know a couple of artists, Molly Birch and Maybird, making their way to Knobs Podcast next week. That's just about it for me. Thanks again to Chris Nickel for getting back to our country and, of course, back to the show. Thank you very much to AtomicFilmShop.com and to PedalGenie.com. Really great to have them on board as well. Let me also close with this. Find me on Facebook. Each and every day I keep getting new ads from people all over the world. They are spreading the show, and I'm asking you to do the exact same thing. Not asking you to give us any money. Just give us some love. Five-star review on iTunes always goes a long way as well. Shares on social media. Get the word out there on Twitter, Facebook, anything else that you do. Hell, we are on Instagram as well. So if you like the show, please get it out there into the universe for us. All right? All right. I am Matt Diamond. I think we did all right on this episode of Knobs.